Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest today is James Lee Burke. We're talking about his latest novel, Every Cloak Rolled in Blood. Now, before we get into the serious discussion about your novel, I want to take a lighter approach at the beginning, because one of the things I admire about your novels is your love of nature and the way that you uphold nature. And there's a quote here. Let me see if I could find this quote here. You say that paradise is real. It's right here in the Northern Rockies. And so whenever I read your novels with the serious plot issues and themes you deal with, there's always this admiration of nature that is in your novels. Talk about nature in your novels.
Well, I was influenced early on by the naturalist, starting with Stephen Crane, of course, and John Dos Passos. But there are many. And certainly, they've influenced me in two ways. Number one, the social ambience is as important as the physical, geographic surroundings. But I think we are, as in the Bible, scooped from the clay. I mean, I'm saying this metaphorically, but that's it. You have to understand the clay if you understand the consequence of God picking it up, breathing his breath into it. But I believe that this is the challenge for us, that we are on the edge of destroying the blue marble. I don't think that's an exaggeration. It's a very critical time, and we're in total denial about the danger we have precipitated. And Texas is, just burning up. And same in California, Montana, and in the third world, my God, it's just that people have been dying for decades now because of the warming of the planet. It's not a hoax. Anyway, I didn't get into that, but after my screen,
okay. So the novel set in the Bitterroot Valley of Montana. Yeah. And the protagonist is Aaron Broussard. He's been in several of your novels. He's an 85-year-old writer whose daughter has died recently. So he is in incredible grief. And he calls a state police trooper when a white supremacist son paints a Nazi swastika on his barn door. And he meets Ruby Spotted Horse, who is a common soul with Aaron, because she is also in grief, but she's about 50 years younger. And despite the age gap, there's a spark between the two.
Yeah. Well, it's true. And there are many foibles and about age. Most of the common wisdom about age has nothing to do with reality. That's it. The only hoax about age, though, is that, at least in my case, I always thought the great mysteries would present a solution. Mystification would go away. But I don't think it hasn't happened in my life. I don't think if older people have learned anything, it's don't try to change other people. It's about as good as it gets.
Take them as they are.
Yeah, that's it.
So the father of this, the young man that painted the swastika on Broussard's barn door, John Fenimore Culpepper, which makes me think of John Fenimore Cooper. And there's a point in the novel when you say he's a man who will never find peace. So this is a character who initially you think you are repelled by him. But then as you learn about the complexity of his life, the mistake he made, and his deep regret for the mistake he made in the past, you begin to become empathetic toward this particular character. And ultimately, he ends up being a tragic character.
He's a complex man. He's uneducated, obviously, and he was a Klansman. He knew the people who blew up the church in Birmingham. And he has, in his own mind, he believes his soul is forfeit. And he's a driven man. And, I remember all those things. I was a newspaper reporter during that period, 1963, 64, 62 in there. But the things that occurred and the people, let me put it in another way. John Grisham's book, The Chamber, has a scene in there, at least the film does, in which a Klansman, a man who's done terrible things, is about to be executed at Parchman Prison. And the warden says to him, well, you know, we're going to have to do it now, son. So is there anything you want to say? And this Klansman, played by Gene Hackman, says, yes, sir, there is. There's many a man I hated in my time, and the one I hated the most is myself. That John Grisham should have gotten the Pulitzer Prize for that one line. That's it. He was taught to hate himself and to vent his anger on the black man. That's what evil is all about.
A lot of the characters in the novel are haunted. I mean, deeply, I don't want to use the word tortured soul, but to some degree, just in deep grief and deep torture. And so this is, to me, to some degree, this is a novel about potentially lost souls trying to find their way back to redemption.
Oh, well, that's been a theme in my work since I began writing. And that's true. Perception is right on it. We meet people who in some way were wounded by historical events, by a creation of a mob, so to speak, and they got somehow involved with it. And they who still have a conscience are left to bear the brunt of the guilt, the depression, the horrible memories that many people have witnessed in their lives and which they cannot share with anyone. We deceive ourselves. We think that the worst things that happen somehow are an aberration. They are not an aberration. They are the rule. Look at the 20th century. There is no century in the history of man more violent, more depraved than the last century. And we may be approaching something even worse today. My last book, which also was narrated by Aaron Holland, Broussard, was set in 1962 in Denver, just before the Cuban Missile Crisis. We think that's all gone away. It has not. It is still there. We are right in the same doorway. We were 2 hours away from nuclear catastrophe. We've pushed it away in our unconscious. It's still there.
You take the concern about historical violence to a whole new level by mapping it into a supernatural element in the novel through the cellar in the house of one of the characters. And at one point in the novel, you write, and I'm just going to take a little piece out of this quote, a panoramic display of historical violence and misery sealed inside her cellar. So you show both the panoramic epic violence that we have participated in, whether we're talking about the Nazis and the Holocaust, whether we're talking about the massacre of Native Americans. But at the same time, you pair that with the evil, the individual evil that men can do, or women like Jimmy Cale, the character Jimmy Cale, who sells meth on the res, or the character Sister Jenny Stokes, who's the pastor of New Gospel Tabernacle. And so talk about the importance, if you can, about presenting the evil, both from an epic scale and on it from an individual scale.
Well, you defined my work that I've been doing for just short of 65 years. That's great, Hopeton. I appreciate it. You're absolutely correct. There, in my mind, two kinds of evil. There is the kind to which all of us are susceptible, namely that we sometimes give up our ability to think, to be cautious, and we allow others to manipulate us and use our virtues against us. For example, rallying around the flag. The flag is always the last was a pitiful attempt of the, oh my heavens, it was Samuel. I didn't mean to get off of that. But I mean, my father used to say, if everybody agrees on it, son, run. They're wrong. Okay. But this is a kind of innocence that causes us to betray what is best in us, and we give up reason and let evil men hold sway in our lives. And it's the herd mentality, but it does not mean that the herd is evil. It is simply vulnerable. I believe, though, that there is another group. These are the individuals who are not of the same tree. Their origins are not in the same tree as the rest of us. That's my feeling. Psychiatrists are the first who will concede that, or actually say that, define their patient sometimes is untreatable because there is no explanation for the degree of anger and depravity that characterizes their neurosis. It is not like the rest of us. There's something different in them. We've been around them many times, but oftentimes we don't know it. This is the psychopath I'm talking about.
So would Major Eugene Baker, who massacred the Native Americans in 1870, close to the land that your main character is living on, would he be the personification of that evil incarnate?
I'm not sure about him. Of course, he who ordered the massacre in 1870 of the Blackfeet Indian who were encamped on the Marias River here in northern Montana. And it was horrible. Probably that was the melee of the Americans' 19th century. But here's what is more disturbing about that murder of all these innocent people. And it wasn't just murder, it went beyond that. And I don't want to even talk about the details. It was a policy. He was not the aberration. He was simply a symptom of it. And after the Civil War, it became the national policy to simply exterminate the Indians. Think of it this way. How did it begin? I can't say for sure, but the same men, many of whom we laud, became not the killers of the enemy in the war between the states, but in Native Americans. And one of the ways, in fact, the chief way, was to starve them to death, to put them on their knees by murdering all of the animals that provided their food, namely the bison. In the year 1830, there were an estimated 50 million head of bison. In the year 1892, there were 200 animals left, 200 bison left, and the Indians were on their knees. One of their advocates, one of the advocates of that policy was William Sherman. Where did he learn it? Well, he was the guy who taught people how war can be hell because he made it hell.
It reminds me about Andrew Jackson and what Andrew Jackson did.
That's it. Jackson did it. Custer did it. And on the, you know, at the, not at the Bighorn, but down there in Oklahoma, or Wyoming, Oklahoma Territory. I forget the name, but he attacked the village, Southern Cheyenne, and the women ran out and tore their blouses, their shirts open to show their breasts, meaning we're women, we have children. It didn't help them. The cavalry, his cavalry, the 7th, just wiped them out. The same thing happened at, of course, in the Sioux in 1890 or 91, it wounded me. But it happened over and over again, and it was genocide.
As our policy, as the policy of the nation.
As a policy, yes, sir. That is absolutely correct. We deny all that.
So we this makes for the patriotism that people have about our country. It's almost like the emperor has no clothes. It's blind allegiance. It's like an immature love of nation that doesn't look and critique the flaws of the nation.
Well, I think we started off wrong, and we still have. It's in our rhetoric. We used the term to conquer the West, was added, conquer the frontier. It's as though it was an enemy. We killed all of the carrier pigeons, millions of them. We killed out the beaver. We just had war with Mother Earth. And the people on the Mayflower, yes, they had many virtues, but they were also a very violent people, and they wiped out the Indians, and they cut off the head of the King of England. These were not a Pacific people. Jeez. Yes, we always think of them as people, with strange hats and strange clothes, and, certainly religious group, but they had a strange way of showing it. So it isn't to berate. There's something in the human being, in the human breast, that when we feel challenged, when we can get a banner over our heads, over something that is really, ultimately evil, we maybe own up to our sins way down when from them, but there's nothing worse than the mob. The term for the mob is les fous, which means the crazy ones. anyway, I didn't mean to proselytize.
So your protagonist, Aaron Holland Broussard, as always, is a deeply flawed character with honor. His grandfather was a Texas Ranger, and you tell this interesting story about how he realizes we really don't have control over our fate at times. And he talks about being dropped as a baby, I believe in the San Antonio River, and being saved.
Yeah. By many. Yeah.
And Snowball.
Yes. Yeah, and Snowball, her little girl. And this is one of the best moments, I think, best scene in the book, I think. And it's the year 1935, right outside of San Antonio and on the banks of the San Antonio River in the midst of the Depression and the Dust Bowl. And he's baptized, this little baby who is our protagonist, the narrator of the novel, Aaron. Aaron, who's held it by the preacher in his arms, and the preacher wades out into the current. Unfortunately, the preacher was drunk and dropped him into the current. And to this day, that little boy, that infant, remembers what happened, and he still has the fears. They're in the unconscious. But he knew he was going to die. He was floating away and wrapped in the blanket, but underwater. And an elderly black lady named Aunt Minnie and her daughter, Snowball, were washing clothes in the bulrushes, in the weeds there, the flooded weeds. And they dumped their clothes and used a wash tub to, they floated it, and they waded out to their breast and grabbed the child and got him into the tub and took him back. And the grandfather, the Texas Ranger, was a man of property. He owned a lot of cotton land, but of course he was going broke. Everybody was going broke back then. But he made an oath to Aunt Minnie, and he said, I say this before the throne of God, that you will never want. You will have a house. You will have succor wherever you need it. He said, I will always be with you and your daughter. And that's, he kept his word. And a young black woman eventually went to school and became a faculty member at Texas University there in Houston.
Texas Southern University. That sounds like that may be based on a real story. I said, that sounds like that may be based sort of on a real story there.
Yeah. Well, all the stories come from somewhere, but I remember when I was a little boy, this was I must have been it was right at the start of the war, and my mother and I and my uncle drove down to Yoakum, and the Dust Bowl was still in effect. I mean, I remember it. And what was so strange about it was there was no light, there was no color, there was dust everywhere, dust up to the bottom of a windmill, and dust piled against the barn, and all the cotton burned away, all the corn gone, and it was as though the light had drained out of the sky, as though there were neither a moon nor a sun. It didn't exist. It was just a story of ink running all the way down the sides of the sky. And I'll never forget that. It's just everything was cold and to the touch. My grandfather had a wood stove that he cooked on, and it was as cold as, boy, the grave. But that's the way it was back then.
So let's talk about the relationship between Aaron Holland Broussard and his departed daughter, Fannie Mae. And he has visitations, and he's not sure whether he's having a nervous breakdown or true visitations.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had one mystical experience where that in effect has happened in my life. I don't talk about it too much. I don't try to convince anybody. I know what occurred. And it was a visitation actually with my daughter, Pamela, whom we lost just a short of 2 years ago. But Pamela was a psychic, no question about it. Since she was a little girl, she's about 2 years old, she'd see things that is extraordinary. But three men appeared to her with a warning for me. And these were men. One of whom was the man who drove me down to my grandfather's house there in 1941 or two, wherever it was. But I don't have any doubt about the presence of spirits in our lives. The three of them, the three men, had a lot of influence in my childhood, but I never gave the names to Pamela. I never told Pamela about them. And one of them was my cousin, upon whom my novel, The Jealous Kind, it's maybe my best book. He was the war hero in World War II. He was an extraordinary man, and I just loved his name was Weldon Mollett, Weldon Benbo Mollett. And he was such a fine man. But they left a message for Pamela, a warning about a truck that would be carrying what looked like pipe, but it was not pipe. He said, it is not pipe, it's something. Anyway, it happened. It actually happened. A log truck slipped its load in front of me going up a mountain. We missed the log by about 18 inches at high speed. Yeah, and there's no way in the world my daughter could have had the information that these men gave me. Their names were Danny Benbo, my cousin that took his life. And anyway, I didn't mean to get off on all that, but I think there's a veil around us. That's what I think. But I don't believe anyone knows. That's it. That's the big cheat about AIDS. That's what I said earlier. I always thought, I'll figure all this out. It doesn't work that way. It's not for me. I'm still waiting.
So there's a big supernatural element. Obviously, we're talking about visitations from his daughter, Fannie Mae. We're talking about encounters with Major Eugene Baker. We're talking about, you know, the cellar with the locked up cellar. But this is really nothing new in terms of the supernatural elements. You had supernatural elements, and I remember in particular in the electric mist with Confederate dead, for example. Mm-hmm. And so this has always been part, and I think in another kind of Eden, though we see that continuation from Colorado, Montana, we're talking about a bunch of people being killed, wrongly killed in Colorado. I think it was the strikers in Colorado. This time it was the Indians in Montana. And the dead, in a manner of speaking, sort of breaking through that veil and encounters with this presence breaking through that veil. Talk a bit as a writer how you incorporate this supernatural element into your mystery novels.
Well, it's a good question. It's a challenge because there has to be a raison d'etre, some degree at least of explanation for these things. But then again, there are things that are not explainable. But there might be someone could say use the term suspension of disbelief that occurs with the reader, but I don't think that's a good way to go. My feeling is that there's certain things in the world that are not explainable. There are entities around us. Those are my conclusions. But I think that maybe there's a possibility in the lives of us all that there's certain levels, different levels of reality.
The other recurring theme, and you talk about it in the book, is providing a voice to the powerless, to the despised, to the oppressed. Mm-hmm. To the, that's, yeah. I mean, in every novel I've read by you, yeah. that is always a big thing that your heroine or your hero are wanting yeah. to represent and provide a voice to those without a voice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. That's it. Every book, every story I've ever written is about that. Yeah.
But, you know, but I, what I think is, it almost, it's inspirational. And I know this is, you know, you're telling a good story, but I will tell you that your heroes and heroines are inspirational because they are deeply flawed. So then people are much more likely to identify with characters who have flaws that we all recognize than heroes who are, with the way they are written, are flawless, have very few flaws. And also the way your characters struggle to make these moral decisions, the way you display the anguish and the struggle to make these decisions. And these are not easy decisions. And I like the way your characters always struggle with these decisions.
Well, thank you. And you're correct. I feel that, the characters that readers of mine, and I have a great readership. The people who read my books, I think, are just really good people. But they make the same statement as you, that what is most appealing is the combination of good and bad that is in the character. And I think, of course, it makes a more realistic protagonist. But I was influenced by many things by George Orwell. I mean, we remember him for 1984, but he was a far greater writer than just that one book would indicate. But there was something he said I never forgot. He said, human beings are always better than we think they are. They keep their mouths shut in the torture chamber. They go down with the ship, the guns blazing, the decks awash. What a line. But that's it.
Well, this is going to be my last question here, and it's a big question, but I'm going to take a big swing here. And I will reveal that I haven't read a lot of the classics, but I will tell you that this novel itself reminded me of Paradise Lost, in a manner of speaking.
Well, it's true. Milton had a lot of influence on me, particularly in the Dave Robichaux books. My novel, Black Cherry Blues, was my Paradise Lost. And Paradise Regained. Yeah. But that's it. You got it. That's it. It's we still have a chance to get Eden back. We've got a chance. But I think we've really gone out of our way to despoil it. There's no doubt about it. It's just the oceans, the pollution, the cynicism, and the narcissism. Golly, Moses. Yeah, but we're on the edge. We're going to have to make a choice to get right.
James Lee Burke, author of the novel Every Cloak Rolled in Blood. I love it. It's deep. These are novels that you deal with some heavy weighted moral issues, but are incredibly readable. That the plot and the way you drive the action is really makes some novels where you think deeply and still don't want to put the book down.
Yeah. Well, I surely appreciate you having me on the show, Hopeton. You always are completely professional and you really do a good interview. So it's an honor to be here.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.